Well, we want to talk in this session about ways in which we can understand our own behaviours. And despite all we say about our relationship with God, most of us are, or if not constantly, are sometimes aware of a credibility gap between what we believe a Christian life is and how we actually act. And Satan has a strategy about that, and his strategy is to dull that awareness as much as he can. So what he really wants to do is to make us as unaware of that credibility gap as he can make us. He wants to lull us into a belief that the way we are acting is normal, standard behaviour for the Christian. So the fact that I am a Christian and I believe in the forgiveness of God, but I have trouble forgiving people in my past, Satan would like me to believe that that's normal, standard behaviour for the Christian, that I have trouble with forgiveness, and that resentment will be part of my journey, and I've just got to live with that. I can't be perfect after all. And so he dulls that awareness so that I put up with bitterness, and I put up with resentment, and I put up with anger, put up with having a short temper. You hear people say, well, of course I've got a bad temper. My father had a bad temper. His father had a bad temper. It's inherited. Well, not really. But we like to believe that. And we Satan wants us to believe that. And the second strategy that Satan has is that he wants to cripple us with guilt about our behaviour. So we know our behaviour is wrong, and we know there's a lot of destructive behaviour going on in our lives. But he wants us to be so guilty about it that we are crippled in the way we respond as Christians. So one man once said to me, you know, I can't express love and affection to my children or to my wife. I'm hard and critical. And he said, on Sunday mornings in church, he said, sometimes I would love to stand up and share something or pray or read the word, but he said, I know that if I didn't, my wife would be sitting beside me saying, hypocrite, hypocrite. He said, I am so guilty about the way I behave that I can't ever be part of worship. Satan has got him right where he wants him, hasn't he? He's crippled him with a sense of guilt. And there are many men and women whose ministries never come to fruition, never come to anything, because they feel so guilty about the credibility gap between what they believe the Christian life ought to be and how they really act. There are many men, for instance, who are conscious of inner struggles, their thought life, their fantasy life, particularly in the area of their sexuality, and so conscious of a tremendous struggle that goes on in there, and a lot of stuff that they don't like about themselves. And Satan has taught them how to feel guilty about that, and that guilt just cripples them. They're only a shadow of what they would be if they could live free from guilt. Not necessarily free from inappropriate behaviour, but free from guilt. That's the second strategy that Satan has. And the third strategy is to encourage us to become secretive and private. I think I've lost count of the number of women who would come up to us after a service or after a meeting and say, my husband would kill me if he knew I was about to say this to you. I remember being in an assembly in another state where we were going to run a marriage enrichment program. And in this particular church, we decided to run a mini marriage enrichment session just to get people used to the idea of what marriage enrichment would be like so that they book in and come, because lots of people are afraid to go to a marriage enrichment. Some of you here might be afraid to go to marriage enrichment, I don't know. Actually, it's a wonderful experience if you ever get the chance to go to a marriage enrichment. You should go. I believe every elder of an assembly, and I say this without any fear at all, that every elder in an assembly should have been, with his wife, should have been to a marriage enrichment. I believe that very strongly. But anyway, at this particular time, we were introducing marriage enrichment. We ran a little session and we got the couples sitting around talking to each other, dialoguing. And over in one corner there was a couple, and he wasn't dialoguing with his wife. What he was doing was in a very loud voice, loud enough for everybody else to hear, made sure it was. He was saying, "What a load of garbage. We don't have to do this. There's nothing wrong with our marriage. This is just a waste of time. Should be preaching the word." Afterwards, his wife came to me in tears, tears just streaming down her face. And she said, "Graham, we've been married for 24 years. It's been 24 years of hell. And the only reason I haven't left him is I'm a Christian." You see, we get into this very private, I must hide from the world my Achilles heel at any cost. Nobody must know the struggle I have. Nobody must know the struggles we have in our marriage. Nobody must know the struggles I have with expressing affection, etc., etc. You're on.
One of the things I think that I found really sad in the assembly that we were just ministering to in Te Awamutu was the fact that in that assembly of about 250 people, there were so many hurting people struggling with events that have happened in their past life and have lived with it secretively, or not feeling that they could share it with the body,
yeah,
that could share their pain.
Yeah.
And to me, I thought that was a sad situation for our church, that we here, there were so many hurting people where they could have entered in a prayerful way and an encouraging way to these people's pain that have never been dealt with. But even within the church, we put on our Sunday faces and pretend these things don't exist.
Yeah, that's right. And that would be true, I would imagine, of most churches, that there's not a freedom to share the struggle that I have. What are some of the common behaviours that cause conflict for the Christian? Well, one of them is anger. Now, let me just say something very quickly about anger. We all know, don't we, that anger as an initial response is an automatic, neutral emotion. In fact, if you know anything about biology, you'll know that there's an aspect of anger which is purely physical. And something happens to you that has caused fear or anger to rise in you, then your body pours adrenaline into your bloodstream, and your heart starts to thump, and your hands go clammy, and your stomach does things to you. And in one sense, you could say you are angry. You didn't even have time to think about it. If someone went out there and backed their car into your brand new Porsche, you would that would happen to you before you could say, "Jack Robinson, you are angry." You see. And so we know that anger is a neutral emotion, but it's what we do with anger that's the issue, isn't it? And so some Christians have not learned what to do with their anger, and so they express it in destructive ways, or more often they suppress it and they pretend they're not angry. And then they get stomach ulcers and depression, and their anger seeps through the pores of their personality and comes out as criticism and sarcasm and cynicism. They're angry, all right, and their anger is beginning to hurt other people as a result. And their anger stands between them and God, and their anger stands between them and prayer, and their anger stands between them and reconciliation with other people in their lives. So anger is one of the common behaviours that cause conflict for the Christian. Is there any comment about that? Anyone here who would like to question that or ask a question about that? The reason it's good just to raise that question now, the question was, how do you deal about it with it? The reason it's good to ask that question now is that's the problem, isn't it? That most of us don't know. I mean, we know that anger's there, but we don't know what to do with it. And we haven't been told a lot. We often get told that it's sinful to be angry, but we're not told what to do with it. And so I want to promise you that I'm going to be very clear on that when we come to it and talk about ways of dealing with anger. The four most common things, or the three most common things that people do with anger is, one, they express it in an attacking, a verbally attacking way, which is destructive, and so therefore it's sinful. Secondly, they suppress it, which means they know they're angry, but they stick it down inside and pretend they're not. And thirdly, they repress it, which means they deny it. That is, they deny to themselves that they're angry, and they deny to everybody else that they're angry as well. They're the three most common ways, and none of those are very helpful. They all lead to sin. There's a fourth way, and let me just tell you what it is, and then we'll come back and talk about it later. It's to confess your anger. Now, I'm not only talking about confessing it to God, but the word confess is a nice word because it brings together the concept of expressing, it's verbalizing, which is a very important thing, but it also brings it together with the concept of owning it as mine, you see. When I express my anger, what is it that we most commonly say when we express our anger? You make me mad. Right? Confessing anger says, I am angry. It still verbalizes it, and it's important to verbalize it, but it owns it. It's mine. It's not blaming people. But we'll come back to that and talk about that in a moment. Second common behavior that causes conflict for the Christian is resentment. And resentment really is internalized anger. Resentment's an interesting thing. There isn't a person in the world that thinks resentment's good. But there's nobody in the world who's resentful for a bad reason. Or resentful for a very good reason. And the good reason is this. We've been really hurt very badly, and we're going to make sure that we never get hurt the same way again. That's a good reason. Who wants to be hurt? So by being resentful, I build up a barrier. I build up a defense mechanism. And that stops people getting close to me again. And if I can keep them at a distance, I won't get hurt again. So it's a good reason, but it's a bad method, right? It's destructive because one of the problems with resentment is my resentment might be because I'm angry at person A, but the person who gets hurt might be person B. Isn't that true? I'm resentful at my mother because she hurt me when I was a child, but who am I hurting now? The children. Or my wife. And resentment's like that. Resentment can never be carried without it being destructive. God was very clear about that, you see. He said that vengeance is only a godlike function. It can never be a human function. God is the only one who can hold an issue in his mind for the purpose of vengeance. Man cannot do it without it destroying him. And I sometimes say that Christians, humans are like paper bags. I don't mean to offend anybody, but we are like paper bags. If you take a paper bag and you fill it with jelly beans, my favourite lolly, then the paper bag will serve as a container for jelly beans as long as you keep it away from me. But if you took that paper bag and you filled it with Coca-Cola, Coca-Cola will go right through the bottom. You see, because they're not built to carry Coca-Cola. Human beings can carry disappointment, discouragement, grief, all sorts of pain. But the one thing we can't carry is resentment. Always remember that, because it's a sin that causes great problem, that causes great conflict for the Christian. Third one's anxiety or worry. Or if you like, we can team it up with fear, number six. Fear is like anger. Fear is a neutral emotion. In fact, fear would save your life. If you went out into the outside this hall and went out to where your car is parked, and you came face to face with a man-eating lion, you'd like to think, all of us would like to think, that our response would be a spiritual response. We'd like to think that we would reach out our hand without a tremble, and we would pat the lion on the face, and we would say, "Nice pussy, I'm a friend of Daniel's." But the chances are you won't do that. The chances are the adrenaline will pour into your bloodstream in such vast quantities that you'll cover the distance between the lion and the front door faster than Superman has ever dreamt about in his wildest dreams. And you would rush in the door, you would slam the door, you would slip down the inside of the door with sheer exhaustion. And then you would say, "Thank heavens for fear. For fear has just saved your life. You've never run that fast in your entire life, and you never will again. Fear has saved your life." But if 25 years later I came back here to Epping and I found you sitting on the floor just inside the door, unshaven, still in the same clothes, I would say, "What on earth are you doing here?" And you would say, "I'll never go out that door again. Every time I go out that door, I meet a man-eating lion. And I'm too afraid. I'm going to stay here for the rest of my life." Then the fear that saved your life 25 years ago has ruined your life. Isn't that true? Correct it. And there's lots of Christians who are carrying around in their lives fear that's wrecking their life. Fear that was once an initial response to an event that took place, but now it just rules them. And there are Christians who are afraid of all sorts of things. The whole life is overshadowed by fear. And sometimes those fears are now being expressed in phobias. And I guess if we went around this little group here tonight today, we'd find a few phobias. People who are afraid of heights. We went up on the tower yesterday, and so I was buying my ticket. I asked the lady if there was a discount for people who had a phobia of heights. She said there wasn't any. Some people are afraid of heights. Some people are afraid of closed spaces. Some people are afraid of open spaces. Some people are afraid of cats, dogs. And interestingly enough, I've met quite a few people who have a phobia of chooks. Hens, you say in Sydney probably. And we have all sorts of interesting phobias. Phobias about spiders. Where do those phobias come from? Because most of the time, most people know that chooks don't hurt you. And spiders, generally speaking, don't leap off the floor, off the ceiling and attack you during the night. They drop on you every now and then. But we're still afraid. I met a lady who, after a meeting, she came and she said, "Graham, I'm really afraid of dogs, terrified of dogs." And I said, I must have smiled. And she said, "No, you don't understand." She said, "When I go out, if there's a dog around, it just terrifies me." She said, "If I go shopping and there's a dog in the street, I just can't get out of the car. My husband just has to do the shopping." And she said, "I'm here at this camp and there's a dog here, a little dog." She said, "I'm terrified. I just can't go outside this building." So I asked her the appropriate questions. What's the most appropriate question to ask somebody who's frightened of dogs? "Right, that's a good question. Have you ever been bitten by a dog?" She said, "No, never." I thought, blow. So that couldn't solve the problem that way. So I said, "Did your parents ever have dogs when you were a little girl?" And she said, "Oh yes. Father had 3 dogs. And he used them as guard dogs because he had a car yard." I thought, oh, blow again. Because if he hadn't had dogs, maybe she was just afraid because she didn't know what dogs were. And then she stopped and she looked at me for a minute and she said, "You know, the only thing I was afraid of when I was a little girl, the only person I was afraid of when I was a little girl was my father." And then she smiled very quickly and she said, but he's a Christian now. And I'm a Christian. And I love him very dearly. And he loves me very dearly." And then usually when I'm talking to people like that, I think the less you can say, the better. So I just stood there and looked at her. And then she said, "Graham, I think I know what happened." She said, "I have transferred my fear of my father to the thing I most associate with my father, dogs." You see, instead of forgiving her father for making her frightened, she transferred the fear somewhere else. And most of our phobias are transferred fears. You see, it may not be acceptable to be fearful of men, but it is acceptable to be fearful of spiders. So if I grew up as a little girl being afraid of men, I might well transfer it onto something that's much more acceptable now. It may not be acceptable to be fearful of people generally, but it's acceptable to be afraid of heights. So I transfer my fear somewhere where it's more socially acceptable and becomes a phobia that just rules my whole life. People are often ripped apart by anxiety and fear. Fourth one is revenge. Lots of people are still locked into getting even. And we've already talked about that, really. The fifth one is manipulation. Some people have learned that the only way that they can ever be sure of getting what they want and what they need is to manipulate people into doing it for them. There's all sorts of interesting ways of manipulation. The person who's always sick, you know, the hypochondriac, is a manipulator. And they are manipulating people into loving them by being sick. If I'm always sick and I'm always weak, then somebody will love me. If you've ever taken a youth camp, you'll come across manipulators very quickly in the camp. You'll find the girl first. You'll find her at breakfast time on the first morning of camp. She doesn't turn up for breakfast. And then some of the leaders go and they find that during the night she's come down with a very serious attack of diphtheria. And they wrap her up in blankets and bring her down to the dining room, and she eats a hearty breakfast. Seems diphtheria doesn't affect your appetite all that much. And during the study, she'll be the life of the party. She'll be sharing, testifying. And then after lunch, some inconsiderate leader will suggest that they go on a hike. During the hike, she comes down with cholera. And she needs to be carried back to camp by the best-looking male leader. What's she saying? She's saying, won't somebody love me? Won't somebody notice who I am? Won't somebody see that I'm a lovable person and I need to be loved? Well, you won't find the boy till a little later in camp, and he'll be the one who climbs the 150-foot gum tree and then can't get down. You've got to call the fire brigade to get him down. But he'll be there. He'll be a cat, no doubt about that. And then when you go back to church, you'll find, gee, there's some growing up ones here. You know, there's the guy who manipulates by threatening to resign off every committee that he's on. And there's the woman who manipulates by getting upset every time somebody takes her job. Yeah, manipulators in every part of society, and always there are people who are saying, won't you love me? Won't somebody notice who I am? And you know, there are many Christians who are very unhappy about being manipulators. They don't want to be manipulators, but it's a learned behavior. They've learnt it ever since they were little tiny children. We knew a family really well, and they had two beautiful little girls. And just the loveliest kids you'd ever see. And the first little girl, the oldest little girl, was the little mummy pleaser. And she was just so good it wasn't true. She was just one of those girls that made you feel up to, if you had it first, you'd want 10 of them. She was just a lovely little girl. The second one was the sort of little girl who cured you of any thoughts of having 10. She was a real little toughie, and she was in the world to have fun right from the day she was born. But this oldest one, she would come into the house several times a day. She would come in with a face so sad. It looked like, you know, just so sad. And she would look at her mummy and she'd say, "Mummy, I'm sad." And her mother, lovely little mother, she would get down on one knee and put her arm around her and give her a cuddle and tell her how beautiful she was and how much she loved her. And away she'd go, really happy, for an hour or so, and then she'd be back, sad again. And remember, we sat down with her one time and said, "Do you see what's happening? Your second little girl has no trouble getting attention. All she's got to do is do something naughty and she gets it. Even if it's getting shaken to her teeth rattled, at least you're looking her in the eyeballs and she knows she's being treated as a human being and she feels okay. But your other little girl, she's not getting any attention at all because she's just so good. So the only way she can get attention is having something wrong with her, by being sad. And if we're not very careful, by the time she's a teenager, she'll have something else really wrong with her. And then by the time she's an adult, she's going to be sick all the time to get attention. Because she has been taught to use this behavior because the rewards have been wrong. And so we talked to this mum about beating her to the gun. And when she was really happy, and when this little girl was really happy to be able to go up to her, put her arms around her and give her a big hug and say, "You're mummy's girl." So that she was rewarded for good behavior and not just for for being sad. And I would imagine that by now the problem is almost gone away. But it's easy, isn't it, for us to develop as we grow up inappropriate behaviours that then trap us. And we find ourselves trapped in that behaviour. When I became a Christian, Cedric, did you have a question? Oh, when I became a Christian, don't dare scratch your ear today, because if you do, I think you're asking a question, like an auctioneer. When I became a Christian, I had a really fiery temper, and I really wanted that temper to go away. I really wanted God to deliver me from that temper. And in lots of ways He did. I think it went underground, really. I'm not sure it was ever cured. But the one time that it used to burst out in the most horrible way was if I banged my head on something. And the reason for that was that I was a child abuse victim when I was a little boy, not in my family, but with a school teacher. And one of the things that she used to do was she used to hit me around the head. And that had almost, I'd blacked that out. It was something I didn't think about until I hit my head on something, and all the rage that was related to child abuse would come back. And I have a very wise wife, but when I whack my head, she used to ask stupid questions like, "Did that hurt me?" And that used to fire up my anger even more. And then she used to get the blame for my hitting my head. And I used to be so ashamed. I said, here I am, a Christian, I'm a preacher, I'm a pastor. And I get so angry. And it was connected to that. And it didn't begin to abate until I learned how to forgive that woman for what she'd done to me. See, I was trapped. I was trapped in my unforgiveness. And it was expressing itself in things that I hated, that I couldn't escape. Seventh thing that people, Christians, are often trapped in is gossip. Now, everybody believes gossip's bad. But you see, what is gossip? Gossip is the passing on of information. And sometimes when we pass on information and we know something that nobody else knows, then that makes me feel a little bit more significant than other people. And gossipers are usually people who are really struggling to find their significance. But in doing it, are hurting other people. There are some people I would never tell a confidence to. Not because they're nasty people. Not because I even think of them as gossips. But because keeping confidentiality is just not their bag. And as soon as they've got information that nobody else has got, it's going to be impossible for them to carry it around without it finding its way out somewhere, because this is my way of finding some significance. And every time they get the opportunity to be significant, they'll take it. And they're trapped in a behaviour that's hooked to the fact that they feel insignificant, and they will gossip. Now, sometimes the gossips are also malicious people. Those sorts of gossips aren't malicious people. Those sorts of gossips just can't keep confidentialities, and they should recognise that and never receive them in the first place. But there are malicious gossipers, and they're angry people, people who want to pay others off for their own angry feelings. And we get trapped in that sort of behaviour. And all of these things become destructive behaviours, and they're destructive. Why? Why are they destructive? They're destructive because they hurt people, and they hurt relationships, and they destroy trust, and they undermine faith. That's why they're destructive. None of the things I've talked about this morning are non-destructive. They're all destructive. And there's lots of other things that I could have talked about too. But they're all destructive. You cannot be resentful without that being destructive. You cannot be bitter without that being destructive. You cannot negatively criticize somebody without it being destructive. You can't put a child down or an adult down without that being destructive. You can't be angry with unbridled rage without that being destructive in some way, some form. I am not here today to say that it's wrong that if you engage in destructive behaviour, then you're a wipeout as a Christian. I'm not here to say that. What I'm here to say is, if you and I continue in destructive behaviour, knowing it to be destructive, then we are very deliberately and consciously living in sin. But once I acknowledge that it's destructive, and then begin with God's help to work on it, then I'm in the healing process. I'm in the growing process that God wants me to be in. That's where God wants us to be. That's where He wants us to be as Christians. Not denying that some of our attitudes and some of our thinking and some of our behaviours are destructive. He wants us in there owning that they're destructive and putting them under the operation of the Spirit of God, so that I'm being healed and I'm being changed. Does that make sense? Is anybody unhappy with that? What I'm saying is that I'm not here to say that if you are currently involved in destructive behaviour, that you're a wipeout as a Christian. In fact, I would say that it's probably more the norm for us to discover some sort of destructive behaviour in our lives. But what I'm here to say is that if I am involved in destructive behaviour and I continue in it, knowing that it is destructive, or I deliberately deny that it's destructive so that I can continue in it, then I am living in sin. But when I own it and acknowledge it and accept it as my behaviour and put myself under the healing process of the Holy Spirit, the healing work of the Holy Spirit, then I'm in the healing process that God wants me to be in. The restoring process. Is that okay? Now let me just go a little bit further with that and say this. Every one of us needs to be in the healing process, because every one of us has a history. Some of us could talk about it as ancient history. I mean, my history goes back half a century and 3 weeks. And some of your history goes back further than that. I can't see anybody, but I hope there's somebody. How about you, Hugh? And some of your history doesn't go back all that far. You can even remember when it started. But all of us have had a history. And in that history, our life has been made up of a series of events. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of events. And some of those have been good events. And some of them have been very painful events. Isn't that right? I must use this thing to try to illustrate this. Whew. Let me see. Some of those events have to do with our early childhood. Some of those events have to do with our family life. Some of those events have to do with our workaday life. Some of those events have to do with school. Some of those events have to do with our teen years. Some of those events have to do with our adulthood. And so, some of them have been very painful events. Events of rejection. Events that relate to bereavement. Events that relate to abuse. Events that relate to being put down. Some of them are single events. They only happened once, but were very traumatic. Some of them were events that have happened hundreds of times, reoccurred all the time. I was talking to a young man. He said that when he was a little boy, his mother left him and his brother, and his father brought them up. But the court said that once a fortnight, they had to spend a weekend with their mother. And he said that he vividly remembers that only from the time he was 2.5 and 3 years of age that he would be taken to his mother's, and she wouldn't want to have anything to do with him. A whole fortnight. The whole weekend. So every fortnight, all his life, till he was 14, he re-experienced the rejection that he felt when his mother left. I haven't sat down to work out how many hundreds of rejections that is. It's pretty painful stuff, isn't it? Some of us have had pain like that. And some of us have had painful events that, well, once, like a man goes out in his motor car and he gets involved in a car accident involving another car driven by a drunk driver, and as a result of the accident he loses his arm. So there's one painful event that changes his entire life. And some of us can think of those things. And to every event, there is, and to most events anyway, it would be true to say that there are consequences. Like the car accident. Consequence of that car accident is that he's lost his arm. And the consequence of an event like a father or mother leaving the family is that from now on I live as a child, I live a divided relationship. The consequence of a widowed mother or father remarrying is that I now have a new father or a new mother, and there's going to be certain differences in that. Consequence of being abused, sexually abused as a child, is that you grow up and for your entire life you feel different to everybody else. And every time you go into a room, you stand in the room and you look around at everybody and you say, nobody in this room knows how I feel. It's a consequence of sexual abuse, and there's consequence to most types of abuse. But as well as consequences, which we usually can't do anything about, there are responses. Now, there are two types of responses. There's initial responses and long-term responses. The initial response may be anger or fear, anxiety, and something I feel automatically. The long-term response is the response I choose to go on feeling. So let's take the man who goes out in his car, he has an accident as a result of a drunk driver, and the consequence of the accident is he loses his arm. 3 years later, this man is still eaten up by bitterness toward drunk drivers, and bitterness because he lost his arm. Is his bitterness the consequence of the accident or his response to the accident? What do you think? His response. Because you see, there could be another bloke in the next street who also had an accident in exactly the same circumstances, who also lost an arm and has no bitterness at all, because he responded differently. So the fact that he only has one arm, that's a consequence, but the fact that he's full of bitterness, that's a response. And every event, whatever that event was, you and I have made responses to it. Our whole life has been full of responses to events. And some of them are really quite interesting. Like little girl who's born into a family, she's number one. And for 2.5 years her parents see her as number one. She gets all the love and attention poured on her. And then an event takes place. Number two comes. Some little girls and some little boys who are number one have a very, very dramatic response to that event. They're hurt, they're angry, and right from that very point they begin to behave angrily because they've been displaced in their parents' affection. Some number ones don't respond like that. Our number one was a boy, and 18 months later, number two arrived. We weren't into family planning in those days. And 18 months later, number three arrived, and so it went on till we found out what was causing them. And but number one was a very confident child. And when number two arrived, I don't think he noticed. In fact, I don't know that he's noticed anything much ever since. He's a psychologist, so that proves it. Wasn't a bit touched by it. But some other number ones have been deeply touched by it. Number two is much more likely to sense and feel rejection than number one is, because he's made responses to other things in his life. So we all make responses. Some of them are positive responses, some of them are negative responses. Those negative responses have a way of going on and on in our lives. And today, 20 years later, 30 years later, we can be responding in exactly the same way. Because although the event is now 20 years back in history, the feelings and the responses are locked into my conscious and subconscious mind, and they are still occurring. And the child who felt rejected 30 years ago still feels rejected when they walk into a room and somebody doesn't say hello to them. And interestingly enough, any experience of rejection seems to trigger off, as a catalyst, all the pain that they felt in that event 20 years before, 30 years before. That's how wonderfully and marvelously we are made. And that's why we all need to be in the healing process of God. Because when we put ourselves in that healing process, as we grow as Christians, God is healing us and restoring us from the painful things in our history. It doesn't all happen like that, does it? We'd all like to think that when we got converted, all those things were dealt with straight away. But the truth is that they weren't all dealt with straight away, because a lot of them have become part of our way of coping with life. When you were 2.5 years of age, you learned how to throw a tantrum. Well, some of you learned how to throw a tantrum. We weren't all tantrumic babies. But many 2-year-olds learn to throw a tantrum. And they learn that if they're in a supermarket, they throw themselves on their back, and they kick their legs in the air, and they bang their head on the floor, and they scream like Blue Murder, that there's a fair chance I might get a chocolate ice cream. There's a fair chance that they belong to some of us, they might get a clip in the ear too. But it's worked often enough, hasn't it, for it to keep doing it. And then they grow up, and of course you don't throw tantrums like that anymore. You see, it's very embarrassing for an adult to be lying on a supermarket or kicking their feet in the air. So we throw tantrums in much more adult ways. We slam doors. We kick cats. We back our car out to drive 60 kilometres an hour. We resign off committee meetings. We change churches. Much more adult ways. Throwing tantrums. But for exactly the same reason. So we can get our own way. Exactly the same. And then God comes along and he says, put away anger. We say, fair go, God. Put away anger. How am I going to get my own way? So we hold on to it. Comes in handy. We use it. And when we get converted, all the garbage goes, but we've got a good hard hold on anything that comes in handy. And we're not going to give that up. As long as there's a chance we might get hurt, or as long as there's a chance we might get rejected, or as long as there's a chance that we might get misused by somebody, we hold on to it as a reflex action. And God comes and heals us. And as he heals us, we let them go. And it's a process. And you're in the process to the day you die. Or you're not in the process because you've made a conscious decision not to be. That's the only two choices. Ooh, we're going to take a long time. I've got a feeling. Any questions so far? Must be, yes.
Is it always possible to discover these source events for destructive behaviours? Or can it be a free floating thing where maybe the person did not really tie the origin as such?
Yes, it is true that sometimes we have a vague sense of anger or resentment or fear and we're not sure where it's come from. Sometimes we can deal with it by not knowing where it's come from, by simply dealing with the fact that we are coping in the present by doing these things and asking and really putting them under the transforming power of the Spirit. But sometimes we do come to a block, and I think that's where probably skilled counselling is important. With most people, with skilled counselling, it's possible to identify where it comes from. I have worked with people who've had big black gaps in their memories, maybe a whole period of 3 years or 4 years or 5 years that they can't remember. And sometimes as old as when they're in their 30s, they can't remember when they were 10 or 12. And met many people who can't remember beyond 10 or 12, which is really unusual. But it's because they've blacked out the pain. But with skill counselling, it's possible for them to get in touch with that pain. And sometimes it is necessary in order to be able to apply the forgiveness to the right issue. Because the person that they're really angry at, but they're not owning that anger, might be a significant adult in their life. Even now that person might still be in their lives, and they can't understand why they can never get on with them. But once they identify that and are able to forgive them, then the healing takes place. But let me say that where skilled counselling isn't available, I'm quite sure that God has his own ways of doing that. And sometimes people, just as they've prayed, have found God has put his finger on something and then realised it and responded to it. So yes, I think God has his ways of doing that. For me, it was a very conscious memory. I knew exactly what I was angry at. And I think most people are, but there are some who aren't.
Lawrence Crabb kind of brings the concept of anger, for instance, as a manipulative behaviour.
Yeah.
Would you subscribe to that kind of approach? Or?
I think in one sense anger is a manipulative behaviour, And for instance, the man who gets angry and raises his voice and uses big words that his wife doesn't understand, that keeps talking like a waterfall, he's using anger to manipulate her into doing what he wants. Or the person who gets angry and withdraws in silence and goes silent for 3 days is manipulating his or her spouse in the same way, by using anger. So yes, it's manipulative. I tend to think that while the behavior itself is manipulative, often the behavior has a root somewhere, and the root is often in undealt with resentment or bitterness. But that's not always the case, because some people grow up in homes where anger is modeled as a way of relating. And we'll be talking about this on Monday when we're talking about angry couples. That some have found that, you know, if I don't get my own way, the thing I must do immediately is get angry. And I think Laurie Crabb has got a picture of, you've got a goal, and here's a person coming for the goal, and suddenly there's a brick wall, and can't reach my goal. So the way that I respond is I blow up in anger. And some have learnt that as a learnt manipulative type behaviour. Yes, that's true. Yes, please.
Response be if we're at the other end of that, like someone is reacting,
yeah,
and you're the one at the other,
right,
the other side.
Yeah. What an angry person wants to do is he wants to do three things. He wants to frighten us. He or she wants to frighten us. He or she wants to make us feel guilty. And he or she wants us to give in. Right? So when an angry person is working their anger out on us, we ought to make a very conscious decision not to wear guilt that's not ours. And Julie developed a beautiful little way of saying to me, Graham, I don't have to wear guilt that you put on me when you're angry. So I think, number one, we must not wear guilt that's not ours. Number two, we must reject fear because, in this case, because the person who's angry is more fearful than we are. Anger comes out of fear that I'm not going to get my own way, or fear that I'm going to be hurt in some way. And so what I need to do is not absorb their fear, not absorb their guilt, and not absorb their fear. And the third thing is that I need to give in if I believe that it's appropriate, but if I believe that to be inappropriate, I should stand my ground until the person's anger is abated and we have a chance to be able to talk it through. If I constantly give in to an angry person, then I'm really digging their hole deeper for them, because that's just another time it's worked. And if I can stand my ground in issues where giving in is destructive, then I should do that. But having said that, let me say I understand that there are some angry people who are also violent, and that it's very difficult to cope with violence like that. And I'm not asking any man or woman to stand their ground if it means they're going to get beaten up. There must be other ways, like leaving. Yes.
If anger. I mean, if you were standing there yelling and whatever at me, it is difficult to sort of think, well, I must not let that go. I mean, it creates a response that you can't be.
Sure.
I mean, Julie must be wonderful if she can do that when you're being angry as well.
For a few years.
Or, you know, to sort of say, well, I'm not going to give in unless this is appropriate.
Yeah.
So that's really, I mean, you have to really work at that, don't you?
Oh, yes, you do. And the other thing is, you see, you have been conditioned to respond to anger a certain way too. So if you've grown up in a home where there was a lot of anger and your way of dealing with anger was running away, you know, going to your bedroom and shutting the door, then that's what you want to do now. So not only have you got to deal with his anger as Norm yells at you, but what you've got to do now is deal with your normal response to anger, and that's to run away, maybe. Or you may have grown up in a home where anger, the best way of dealing with anger is get angrier than the person. So you yell back. So you have to overcome that tendency to want to do that. So there's a lot of dynamics happening, and it's not simple. And I think that's what Julie had to do, wasn't it? You might like to comment, but Julie's way of responding to anger when we were first married was...
To go quiet. Mm. But I realised a lot of the things that you used to get uptight about was out of your control.
Mm.
Like
control.
Yeah, so that if I wasn't ready 10 minutes early when, you know, we were going to leave, we were supposed to be gone or something,
yes.
You'd be getting all agitated and then start blaming me until I realised, well, I'd done all I could. That was your problem, providing I wasn't purposefully trying to keep you late.
Mm.
I saw that as being your problem, not mine.
Yeah. But Julie used to say, well, we're still 10 minutes early, and if you're going to have a nervous breakdown, it's your problem. You see? Now, that used to make me madder. I learned after a while, she's right. She's dead right. And, you know, I used to help her a lot. When we used to go out, and she used to be late, I used to help her a lot. I used to sit in the car and toot the horn. And then after she began to lay that sort of stuff on me, and I began to really work that, and I realised that she was a security person, and she was not going to be happy going out until she checked all the windows and all the doors and switched off the gas and put the clock out and wound up the cat. And then I realised that it was my problem, and I needed to get in there and help her do that. There's another problem, though. Because she was a security person, after I'd done all that, she used to have to check it anyway. Sound like your place? Anybody relating to that? Good. So in the long term, if I deal with my response to anger in such a way that I now respond more appropriately, then I help the person. But when I'm responding inappropriately to a person's anger out of my own fear or my own learned behaviours, then I'm not helping them. And that's what we do with alcoholics' wives or alcoholics' husbands. We'll often sit down and teach them more appropriate ways of responding to their partner's drinking or their partner's hostility. And it's amazing how once they develop a more appropriate way of responding, that person's behaviour changes. See? Because it becomes a vicious circle. You know, I get angry, you run for cover. I get angrier because you run for cover. You know? But I get angry and you say, hey, wait a minute. I am quite sure that I haven't done anything to make you that angry, so the anger is your problem. And you stand there, I'm up against a brick wall, I've got nowhere to go, except to back off and eventually say, it is my problem. I do act in that manner. Does that make sense? Okay. We're all running ahead looking for the solutions real quick and I haven't got there yet. Where are we? Where do destructive behaviours originate? Well, they originate from our sin nature. James 4 tells us that, and many other passages of Scripture tell us that. They originate from sinful long-term responses to events in our lives. We've already talked about that. And they come from a refusal to own emotional responses as our own. Colossians 3:8-11 talks about recognising anger and malice and resentment and putting it off. Why do we continue in destructive behaviours? Well, one is because they achieve what we really desire. You know, a person who's behaving destructively does so because they're getting what they want. That behaviour is geared to achieve something. And if it's still achieving it, they keep doing it. So that if by getting angry, I get my own way, I stay being angry. No matter how destructive it is, I'll keep doing it because I'm getting my own way. And basically, we're selfish human beings. We're selfish beings. And even though it may cost me my family, I'll keep doing it. I'm locked into it because it's the only way I know of feeling secure. It's the only way I know of being powerful. And I have worked with people who've continued with behaviour they know is going to cost them their wife, and their children and their health, and they keep doing it, and they won't stop it because they are locked into the rewards it gives. Even in terms of church life, why does a person go on being angrily rigid about things they can't prove are biblical? Because the reward is feeling secure. That's the only way I can feel secure, is being angrily rigid. So I will withstand any suggestion of change, even if it splits the church, even if it costs us our pastor, even if it costs us our eldership. I'll stay strongly opposing that, even though I know it's destructive, because it's the only way I can feel secure. And so the reward for that behaviour is feeling secure. The cost of moving away from that behaviour is to feel insecure. Do you understand what I'm saying? It's really important to understand that, because that's one of the reasons we stay with destructive behaviour. Why does a husband keep criticising his wife, even though he knows to criticise her in public is destructive? Because criticism is hooked to inner anger, and he is dealing with his anger by getting revenge. And his way of getting revenge is to criticise her in public. So he keeps this destructive anger, he keeps it under some level of control by criticising her. If he stops criticising her, the anger is going to bubble up and destroy him. So he keeps doing it. Or he uses criticism as a way of making sure she doesn't dominate him. The thing he is most fearful about is being dominated by a female, because he was dominated by a dominant mother. And so the way he's going to keep her under is to criticize her. And that way he's got the power and she doesn't. And the reward is that it does something about his fear of being dominated. Do you see what I'm saying? That he's getting rewards. And even when you say to him, that's wrong, he says, I know it's wrong. But he can't stop doing it, because he's getting rewards for doing it. Until he realises that it's sinful and he's prepared to put it, confess it and deal with it, he'll keep doing it. And even when he does confess it, he's got to live with a whole lot of new fears that now come up because he's not doing it anymore. He's got to live with the fear that his wife's going to dominate him like his mother used to. And he's given up his way of control. And he has to learn how to deal with that fear. So it's a process of healing. I've worked with men at this very level who have confessed their anger to God, have been forgiven, have ceased being critical of their wives, and then for the next few months they have just about had a breakdown. Because the fear that they're going to be dominated rises to the surface and starts to claw at them. And what they have to do then is realise where that's coming from, and they have to work back and forgive their mum for hurting them so deeply. And once they've forgiven their mum, then they don't have so much fear. You sort of see the circle. And so it's a process of healing. You deal with something, it might create another problem. You've got to work through that problem until God has healed that for you. But that's important. Why do we continue in destructive behaviours? Because they achieve what we really desire. And secondly, because we refuse to apply the biblical principles of love, acceptance and forgiveness. Christians like to think they're loved and forgiven and accepted by God, but we won't apply the principles that we must live in the process of applying those things. Jesus made no mistake about it. We have to love and forgive and accept as he's loved and forgiven and accepted us. And many Christians will not apply that principle. Julie and I go to churches all over Australia. We preach forgiveness almost everywhere we go. And time again, almost every time, people will come out of the church and say, you know, we've never heard that in our lives before. We've heard that God has forgiven us, but we have never heard that we are now obligated to the Spirit of God to forgive others. We are now obligated to the Spirit of God to love others. Brothers and sisters, we must preach the whole gospel And the whole gospel is not only have we been loved, forgiven and accepted, but we are called to live in the freedom of loving and forgiving and accepting others. We must not overlook that. The third reason we continue in destructive behaviours is because we have a low view of grace. The only reason one of the reasons I'll go on living in destructive behaviours is I don't understand how much it's cost God to set me free. I don't have to go on living like that. If I understood the grace of God and how deep and unlimited the grace of God is, that would make it much easier for me to give up my destructive behaviours. And the fourth reason we continue in them is because we compartmentalise our behaviours. We have Christian behaviours and secular behaviours. We have Christian areas of life and secular areas of life. Basically, Sunday is given to God and the rest of the time we have secular behaviours, and we can actually excuse destructive behaviour on the basis that we don't do it on Sundays. That's a bit cynical, but I hope you get my point. There are people who can smile and sing like angels on a Sunday who are not nice to live with the rest of the week. And we have to learn how not to compartmentalize our lives. We have to learn to see our lives as a total whole, and God owns it all. Now we come to the solutions. Well, we've waited a long time, so let's hope we don't get too disappointed. What are some of the solutions to dealing with destructive behaviours? How can I deal with them? One of the things I must do is to own, the first thing I must do is to own all negative emotion as my own. Stop blaming others. What do we mean by that? The anger and the resentment and the fear and the anxiety that now eats away at my life belongs to me. It is my response to life. Now, to do that, I have to separate between the person who hurt me and my response to the person who hurt me. And one of the things that happens in child abuse is that the child will frequently carry the blame for the event. Many women I talk to who were the victims of child abuse when they were children, now in their 40s, still believe that somehow, in some vague way, they were guilty for that. That they were responsible. I hope that that's not as prevalent in today's world as it was. But it used to be always the case that the girls would feel somehow guilty. Now, that's not the way to go to healing. By accepting guilt that's not mine doesn't help. What I need to do is to move the guilt for the event to whoever was responsible for the event. I can't forgive them until I've blamed them properly, until I've laid the blame in the right place. So if I excuse my father for what he did to me when I was a little girl, then I'll never get round to forgiving him. I can only forgive him when I blame him for it. When I lay the blame where it really belongs, then I can forgive, but only then. If I take the blame myself, I can't work through it. I've got to accept responsibility for my responses, but I must put the blame for the event where it belongs. The man who was lost his arm because of the drunk driver, he's never going to overcome his bitterness by accepting the blame for the accident. He's got to blame the drunk driver for the accident and then forgive the drunk driver. That's very important. But he's got to own the bitterness as his. That's his bitterness. It's nobody else's. So the first step to overcome destructive behaviour is to recognise that destructive behaviour comes out of dysfunctional emotions and dysfunctional thinking, and what I have to do is identify that and own it as mine. And sometimes, if it's not important to remember the event, I might simply have to say, somewhere, someone dealt with me in such a way that I responded by being fearful. I need to forgive the person who made me afraid, whoever that person was, on the basis that Jesus died for their sin too. And then I must accept the fact that the fear is mine, and I need to deal with that. So that's how I would deal with it. Now, sometimes it's necessary to do that. In most cases, by getting some help from another person, it's possible to identify the event. And I would say to a person who feels really stuck, and they've tried and tried and tried, and they haven't made any progress, I would say, find somebody who's skilled in that area. Now, yeah, let's come back to that later, but that's what I would say. Yes.
Brian, you did mention that to find somebody who might be able to help you to that event, would you go so far as hypnosis and rebirthing?
I generally don't think that hypnosis is necessary. I think that there are much better techniques and much healthier techniques than hypnosis. I know enough about hypnosis to know that a lot of what Christians fear about it is probably not true. But on the other hand, I think that there are better methods than hypnosis. I would seek out either a very good Christian counsellor who's skilled in the therapies that enable people to recognise what's been going on for them, or even a very good secular psychologist who is not anti-Christian, who is good at his work, can help a person who's really in a heavy way. But let me come back and say, most of us are not that deeply wounded. There will be one or two people in this group, in a group this size, who are that deeply wounded they need that sort of help. But I think in general, most of us can plug back fairly accurately into the painful area in our life and to the major people who would have figured in that. Now, we might not be able to remember the actual event. Like women will often say to me, I know there was a lot going on in my childhood. There was a lot going on between my mother and my father because when I was 15, they split up. So there was obviously a lot going on there. And I know I have a fear, I've grown up with a sort of a fear of trusting my father. I can't remember what happened, but I know there was a lot going on there. Then I'd have no problem just saying to that person, well, what we need to do is I want you to think through what it means to forgive your dad. That we might not have to plug into something specific. But if it was a deep woundedness, and I knew it was a deep woundedness, and a real blockage there, then I would use a counselling, a therapy that would enable us to go slowly back through the life and unlock some of those areas. And it would not be hypnosis in my case, but some might use hypnosis. I don't condemn people who use hypnosis, but I don't know that I would encourage a person to go to a hypnotist. Anyone else? So the first step is owning that emotion is out, the negative emotion out. Let me say that that's the hardest step. That's the reason why most people don't deal with destructive behaviours. Because it's really hard to say, after I've really been hurt by someone else, it's really hard to say the anger's mine. Because it seems unfair, doesn't it? If that person did that to me, then it must be their fault that I feel like this. And it's really hard to take that step to say, no, until I own this as mine, I can do nothing about it. As long as I blame someone else for it, I'm stuck. But if I can say, yes, Lord, it's my anger, then I'm in a position to do something about it. Only then. And so we need to own it and stop blaming others. And the second important step in dealing with destructive behaviour is to identify the sins we are committing against others as a result of our negative feelings, our destructive behaviours, and our dysfunctional thinking. Now, what do I mean by that? Because that seems a strange step. When somebody comes and they say, what I'm really trying to deal with is my anger, and I'm really angry at someone in my past, Once we've worked at accepting responsibility for those feelings and those behaviours and those dysfunctional thinking, then I want to switch direction a bit. And I want to say, now before we go any further, I want you to have a look at the present. What's happening in the present? And who around you is being hurt by your behaviours? Who around you is being hurt by your dysfunctional thinking? Who around you is being hurt by all those negative feelings? And people will often stop and say, well, I do give my wife a bad time. I do give my husband a bad time. I do give my children a bad time. And what I want to do is to help people see that the reason for dealing with this stuff is not because of the past, but it's because of the present. We live our lives in the present. We're not into digging up the past, we're into helping people deal with the present. And the way of dealing with the present is seeing how much hurt I'm causing by hanging on to this behaviour and this thinking and this feeling. And as a Christian, if I can own that and I identify that, I've got an out. The out is that I know I can be forgiven. But until I own it, I can't be forgiven. David could not be forgiven, and we were reminded before by Don, he could not be forgiven until he owned that the sin was his. And when he owned that the sin was his, then he knew that all the beautiful experiences of Psalm 51 could be his. And I have sat with men, particularly men who have wept very deeply as they realised how deeply they have sinned against their sons by withholding affection from them and by criticising them and putting them down out of their own anger. And as they've wept about it and as they've come before God and confessed it to Him and God has forgiven them for it, a new freedom has come. Do you know what Jesus said about forgiveness? He said, you can't forgive until you've been forgiven. You forgive out of your experience of being forgiven. And so as these men have been forgiven by God, now they're in a position to forgive their father or whoever it is they're angry at, because they know what it is to be forgiven. I even had a non-Christian man. He came to me, he was a very angry man, and he said, Graham, I've come to you out of sufferance. He said, a friend of mine said that I should come to you, but he said, I know you're a Christian and I am anti-Christian. And he said, I want you to promise me you won't talk religion. And I said, yeah, I'm happy about that. I never talk about religion, if I can help it. Didn't say anything about Christianity, just said religion. So I said, okay, I won't talk about religion. So for the first few weeks, we just talked about his anger toward his father. And one day I said to him, John, who is it that you're hurting because you're angry? Here's a piece of paper, write it down. And he wrote down five names. His three children, his mother, and his mother-in-law. He said, you've got no idea how much I've hurt these people. And the tears came in this angry man's eyes as he thought about what he'd done to his family, and a fear started to creep over my heart. You see, I had introduced him to this step and it suddenly struck me, but he doesn't know about God. And he doesn't know about God's forgiveness. What will happen to this man? And I said, John, what are you going to do about this? What are you going to do about all this guilt you're starting to feel? He sat there with his head bowed for a minute. And then he looked up and his eyes were shining and he said, I know what to do. I'm going to go to every one of those people this week and I'm going to ask them to forgive me. Now, I have a little golden rule as a counsellor, and the rule is I never think about my counsellees from one session to the other. I can't afford to. If you have 8 people a day or 6 people a day, 5 days a week, you can't be thinking about them all week or you go bonkers. So I have a rule, and the rule is that I give them to God and I don't think about them, they leave them with God, and I don't think about them until I walk into the office. But several times that week I thought of this man. I thought, I wonder what's happening. What happens if he goes to these 5 people and they all tell him to get lost? Because here I've introduced him to a reason to feel guilty, and I really haven't been able to introduce him to a solution. But anyway, I worried a bit, and the next week he came back and I said, well, John, how did it go? He said, I went to those 5 people and I asked them to forgive me, and he said 4 out of the 5 said, yes, John, of course we want to forgive you. And I said, what about the 5th one? And he said, well, she's been very deeply hurt, Graham. And it's going to take her a long, long time to learn how to forgive me. He said, in fact, it might take as long for her as it's taken for me to learn to forgive my dad. Well, now I had a new problem. This bloke had got better and he wasn't a Christian yet. And I really felt guilty about that. I smiled at him and I said, John, you've just broken our contract. And he said, what are you talking about? And I said, you said that we weren't going to talk about religion, right? He said, yes. I said, you just have. He said, what do you mean? I said, you have just told me the central aspect of the gospel. You have just said that because you've experienced forgiveness, you are now free to forgive another. He said, that's how I learned about forgiveness. God forgave me my sin, and now I learned how to forgive others. And he grinned a very big grin and he said, you horror. But that opened the door, and from then on we were able to share. But you see, he was on a journey now, a journey that would eventually lead him to Christ, although I don't know the end of the story, but a journey that will lead him to Christ because he has learned the power of forgiveness. Now that's not the way I learnt to preach the gospel when I went to college. God has his own ways. And I was thrilled and excited about that. The third thing, the third step in dealing with destructive behaviours is when I identify the sins that I'm committing against others as a result of my negative feelings, destructive behaviours and dysfunctional thinking, I need to confess these as sin and accept God's forgiveness. And then, having accepted God's forgiveness, the fourth step is to forgive, love and accept others as Christ has forgiven, loved and accepted me. Let me just tell you some quick little thing about forgiveness. Do you know what the definition of forgiveness is? Really clock into this. I know you're tired and I've worn you out, but just take this and write it down. Forgiveness is loosing another or freeing another from the obligation to suffer at my hands for something he has done to me. Forgiveness is freeing another from the obligation to suffer at my hands for something he has done to me. You know what that means, brothers and sisters? Forgiveness is not something I give to a person. It's an act I commit. When somebody comes and says, will you give me forgiveness? The answer should be no. Forgiveness is nothing I can give. It's only something I can do. And yes, I set you free of the obligation to suffer for what you've done to me. I no longer hold you under that obligation. That's what God said when Jesus died on the cross. When Jesus bore the cost of my sin in his body, God said to me, Graham Cann, you are no longer under an obligation to suffer for what you've done against me. And when I received that forgiveness into my life, then I had appropriated the act of forgiveness that God performed on the cross. And when we forgive another on the basis of the death and resurrection of Jesus, we set them free. Let me finish the session by asking you two questions. You haven't asked me too many. Let me ask you two. I want you to answer it loud, okay? Do you believe that Jesus has died for every sin that you have ever committed or will ever commit in your entire life?
Yes.
Good. Do you believe that Jesus has died for every sin that's ever been committed against you and will ever be committed against you by anyone else? Not quite so loud. Some of you had the feeling it was a trick question. It is a little bit. Because you see, if we said no, it makes nonsense out of our first answer. Because if Jesus has died for your sin, Jesus has died for the other man's sin. But if we say yes, it means that to stay angry at something somebody has done is irrelevant, because God has already paid the price. And because God has paid the price in Christ, on the basis of the death and resurrection of Jesus, I can say to the person who I'm angry at and out of whom my destructive responses have come, I am able now to say, I set you free. And from now on, I accept responsibility for my destructive behaviors. And from now on, I give them over to God as they happen and accept his forgiveness and his freeing. And through his power, I will grow beyond them. And that's exactly what happens. But we have to begin with the healing first. We have to begin with the freeing first. We have to be set free through the process of setting others free.